This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. A very happy new year to all of you. Just as we did last January, we'll bring in this new year with a series of programs featuring new music and chat with important composers of today. We begin with the New Hampshire-born Gregory Brown. Mr. Brown has connections to our area, being an alum of Westminster Choir College, but his music now has made his name known across the country and abroad. He focuses on music for voice, particularly choral works, and one of his biggest successes to date has been the extraordinary pairing of the setting of the Latin Mass and words of Charles Darwin from his Origin of Species in his Missa Charles Darwin. Music from that work inspired his sibling to turn out one of his latest best-selling novels called Origin. His brother is mega best-selling author Dan Brown of Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demon, etc. fame. And yes, there's already talk of a movie version of Origin starring Tom Hanks in the works. So my guests' music will not only be part of the storyline, but the soundtrack. My guests' output has been embraced by some of the top performing vocal ensembles around, including the fabulous Philadelphia-based ensemble The Crossing, led by Donald Nally, and also the male vocal quartet New York Polyphony. In fact, it was that group that ignited the inspiration for the Missa Charles Darwin. That's them singing from my guest's Three American Hymns, a setting of The Dying Californian. But nothing dying about my guest, this firm East Coast and New Englander's career. Gregory Brown stopped by our studios a few months back.
Wish I could once more caress them ere I sink beneath the sea. Tell my sister that I never found that store of precious songs, but I found a place called heaven where the gold will never rust. But I
happy to be here today with composer Gregory Brown. You're a New England guy, but you're down here in our area, and you do have a connection to this part of the world, so I just thought we'd start there. What's your connection to this part of the world?
Yeah, I came down here for my master's degree. I went to Westminster Choir College with a degree in conducting. I graduated in 01 and sang a lot here. I learned a lot of music. I learned a lot of wonderful things here. Yeah. So it's great to come back. I was on campus yesterday. Yeah. Got a chance to check in with the old place. They have some beautiful new buildings to see, and looks great.
Yeah, they're going through an interesting time right now, and we'll see what happens as they come out the other end. And
yes.
You, along with me and many others, are interested to see how that great institution weathers everything.
Indeed.
Also about you is science and music. You grew up in a household that exemplifies that both divide and combination. You yourself, it's through your schooling, you had to make a decision and go one way or the other. So sort of take us the path from growing up and how those two worlds mixed with you. And then, like I said, you had to make a decision to not only be in music, but be a creator of music too. So to give us a story.
So in my house, my mom was a church organist. She had her master's in sacred music. She actually went back to school as an adult in her 40s. So my memory as a kid was her studying for her exams. And so, you know, we'd be in the car and she'd have a cassette with all of her listening examples. So, and I actually got pretty good at sort of picking them out as a kid. I used to go, and instead of having a babysitter, she'd take me along and she'd practice organ, and I would goof around in the church. I used to love and come up behind her and pull out the 32-foot stop without telling her, and That was my idea of fun when I was 12. And my dad was a math teacher and a specialist in symmetry and Escher in particular. I have a very particular memory of one of Escher's sons coming to the house and speaking with my dad for a few hours and giving him slides and all sorts of background information about what it was like to grow up in the house with Escher. We had Escher prints all over the house, and those ideas of that particular type of art, which was fascinated with quasi-mathematical or straight-up mathematical background and structure to them.
Right.
When I went off to school, I was going to be a computer scientist. That's what I wanted to be. And I got there and I took calculus, BC Calc, which is the second year of, or the second semester of calculus, and I did not do very well. But I was also taking geology, and I loved geology, and I decided I was going to be, all right, I can still do computers and geology. I spent 2 years in the geology department doing field work, lab work, the whole nine yards. Went out and did some really interesting research into tourmaline chemistry and pegmatites in western Maine, which was actually a lot of fun. Co-authored a paper in it. My first publication was essentially a geochemistry. Anyway, I was spending more and more time in the rehearsal space, you know, with the choir. I was in an a cappella group. I was in a madrigal group. Right. I was starting to get more and more interested in composition and conducting. You said it was a choice to go into music, but my advisor in the geology department, it was less of a choice and more of a sort of, you might want to think about, you're not really spending the time in the lab that you should. You should probably go and be a musician.
Right.
And so I dug into that, and my last 2 years at Amherst College were almost entirely music classes so that I could fit the major in.
Your parents were cool with whichever way. I mean, because they themselves lived a split life of science and
absolutely.
Music.
And my dad... You know, for as much as he was, his math mind, he wrote math books, he was lecturing about math all the time.
Right.
But he also loved barbershop. He was the major general in the town production of Gilbert and Sullivan. He was in Oklahoma and our town. He was on stage all the time as a singer and an actor. You know, so there was always music in the house, even from my dad.
For my guest, Gregory Brown's three-movement work setting a 16th-century Italian text by some Catholic reformers who were quietly promoting what Luther was making happen at that time just north of them. The work is titled Vidi Aquam. This movement, called To Stir Up Our Wits, sung by The Crossing, led by Donald Nally.
Thank you.
said how you were, you know, performance-wise in school, you're in choirs and small chamber choirs and all the rest of that. Much of what one can hear of your music on recordings is vocal music, choral music, text setting. And I thought we would just go there. As far as when you wanted to create, was it natural that you're going to write for the voice? There are composers who shy away from that. There's composers who, I mean, one thinks of like Joan Tower, who just for decades, just nothing for the voice. So it can be a scary area. Was it just a foregone conclusion you were going to write for the voice when you started to compose?
It just felt natural to me. I'm trying to think about it, and I don't know what the connection was. I've always loved poetry and language. And I think there was a really just a natural step for me of taking the spoken language, the written language, and making it into music. And even actually when I write instrumental music, I'll have a text in mind when I'm writing it, which comes out of sort of a Janáček school of thought about how music works and how you take these speech melodies and turn them into so-called pure music.
Obviously, the idea with writing vocal music is you do have a text. Now, choosing text, and this is a big area for you, like a lot of composers kind of in your generation span, texts are not always poetic. They're not even maybe logical musical context texts. They might come from transcripts or prose or speeches or something no one would think of to set to music. So just talk about first about text. How do you filter what is going to be set, what you want to work with and all that? Just how's that process work?
I usually know within a line or two whether a text is settable. And what I'm reacting to is I will speak it out loud. And there's a sort of a mouth feel, how the vowels, as a singer, I just react to the vowels and how the vowels sort of develop through a line. And if that text has sort of what it takes to be settable, then I'm looking at the imagery, what's in it in terms of imagery, how does that fit with other things I'm looking at? And it becomes sort of a long list, a short list, and then you make a choice. There are other times where people say, I want this text set. And I did a piece recently, commissioned for a choir in North Carolina, and the director said, I want this exact text. And I said, okay, there we go.
Okay, so you're reading a couple lines and you start saying, yes, I can set this, and music ideas start coming. But the range of what you set veers from poetic, non-poetic, prose, mundane, descriptive, narrative, the whole gamut. So how do you navigate that, saying this is going to work, this isn't going to work? I mean, because some things just really are difficult to set to music. And you don't need music to set them. It's like the old, Auden said, you know, no one writes an opera about someone taking a shower. You know, I mean, music doesn't elevate it, put it that way.
Yeah, there is something. And you hit on it. I start hearing music. There are certain poems or prose that I read and I start hearing music.
Right.
I start hearing rhythmic ideas. I start hearing melodic ideas. And I just know. I don't know that there's any better way to say it than just sort of experience and intuition. You say, okay, yeah, I can do this.
But you must run into running that whole gamut of text. Like, you're not working with poetry that either has a rhyme or has a rhythm already in it, that you must get and say, this doesn't work, or, you know, you're going to hit dead ends with some of that stuff. Where...
And I just go a different direction. But, I mean, if in the case of sort of a text that you're presented as you must set this, and that's happened a couple of times, I have to start thinking about it in different terms, whether I'm going to be thinking about this text in a sort of almost modernist sense of like, all right, am I going to take this apart? Am I going to focus on this vowel sound and how this vowel sound works with this, how this word rhymes with this, how this rhythm might rhyme with that rhythm? And it just becomes a sort of a different type of challenge. It's not impossible, but it's not my favorite way to work, but it's a good challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
From a work about a topic close to my guest's heart, the making of the Quabbin Reservoir in western Massachusetts back in 1938, where they displaced all the human inhabitants and flooded the valley. The work is called Unbodyings, UN/bodying/S. We'll hear the second movement, The Valley of the Lost Names. Once again, The Crossing is led by Donald Nally, music of my guest today, Gregory Brown.
Far that was
The music you put onto this text, I mean, your music, from what I've been able to hear, there's very contemporary styles of vocal and choral singing, really sort of mashed up against this heavy homage almost to the great polyphonic writing of the medieval and Renaissance periods. Mm-hmm. Explain, I mean, how do those worlds fit in your head? Because they seem to predominate.
I love it all. I mean, I'm an omnivore when it comes to music. I'll listen to really just about anything. I have two young kids and, you know, I'll have my iPod hooked up to the car and Alvin Lucier will come on. Well, I'll be like, okay, this is cool. And then some country thing will come on. Okay, whatever. Izak, fine. And it's all just part of this sort of soup that we, it's a stew that I listen to on a daily basis. When I think about sort of the integration of that into music, I think about people like Brahms or Ligeti, where if you start to really pull it apart, you see the influence of that earlier polyphony and canons and all those things that we think about as high Renaissance, but really in many ways permeated later generations, Bach. And there's a joy to me in creating a polyphonic texture, whether that's canonic based or whether it's strictly multiple independent lines working together. There's something about that, and I think that speaks to something which gets back to sort of the science stuff. When I was a kid, I loved taking stuff apart. I loved knowing how things worked. I loved Lego. I loved airplane models, World War II airplane models. I loved putting things together. And it's a way for me to get into music. It's a way for me to find joy, to say, okay, well, this melodic fragment can work with this. Okay, what if I turn them over? What if I turn them backwards? What if I spin them on their end? And it makes the process a process which is very enjoyable to me, to think about music in this modular way and to find a way to also create beauty in the ways that things fit together or maybe rub up against each other as a result of processes that you set in motion.
I mean, in the choral world, your music, because it has
has that polyphonic nature. It's very linear in the fact that there's a lot of independent lines, whereas it's interesting because the kind of the choral world, the hot, you know, you get these hot composers, right? And if you look back over the last decade or not two decades, you know, whether it's Morten Lauritsen, Eric Whitaker, Eric Essenvaltz, people like this, Ola Yelo, it's these lush harmonies, right? This sort of stacking of sound. Your music kind of moves linear.
Well, I love those sounds. I love those verticalities, sure. Those sonorities. I need more harmonically, though. I want to go to even weirder places. And for me, I get there by creating independent lines and sort of shaping them in such a way that they go to these places. In the piece that I wrote for The Crossing last year, you know, I have these chords, like 24 notes, you know, floor to ceiling. And sort of creating a place where I can do that, right, and get there organically. So it's not just like, whoa, noise. It's like, oh no, we're getting to this really deeply coloristic place. I wrote some pieces for Skylark Ensemble in Boston, and there's this one chord, and the director called me and said, what is this thing? And I said, no, it's great. I don't know what it's called, but it's great. Just trust me. And it ended up being great, but it's it just comes out of this sense of exploration and wanting to sort of push into different places.
Ignorance more frequently begets confidence than does knowledge. Kyrie eleison.
So from my guest Gregory Brown's Misa Charles Darwin, using the ancient mass ordinary of the Catholic Church as structure and using text, words from Darwin's Origins of Species, here is the opening movement in Troitus, Tropus, and Kyrie, sung by the group for whom it was composed and who also inspired my guest to write it, the Male Quartet New York Polyphony.
So we've talked about this connection with music of centuries ago, and that even extends to the work that's brought you the most recognition of taking one of the great forms that came out of the polyphonic vocal age that composers set by the thousands because they had to.
Yeah.
And that's the mass, standard mass settings, but this work, we go back to text. It's a text that probably no one would think to set, and probably this person who the text come from is probably on the list of people you would furthest distance from the sacred world of the mass. There's a lot to talk about here. So the Misa Charles Darwin, maybe give us its genesis, tie into to Darwin here, how it came to be, and just your whole thought process of doing this.
Yeah, so the Misa Charles Darwin came out of sort of a little almost aside from Craig Phillips, who sings as the bass in New York Polyphony. Mm-hmm. Which is the group that I ended up writing the piece for. And I was working at Smith College in Northampton, Mass., and New York Polyphony was coming to do a show, and I was helping just sort of do some of the logistics. And Craig said, oh, hey, by the way, I have this idea. I want to bounce off to you. What do you think? So he outlined this idea of doing a mass structure but using texts from Darwin. And I just sort of thought about it for an hour or two and then said, yeah, let's do this. This feels really like a way for me. Because I feel like as a choral composer, I have to write a mass, but I'm not a believer. And so to write sort of a standard Latin mass felt inauthentic, or it just, it didn't feel right. I had written a Missa Brevis maybe, 5 years before, and I had sort of found a way to make it my own. But still, it was essentially just a very short Latin mass. And this, when Craig brought this idea across my desk, it was like, oh, okay, this is a way that I can talk about science and someone whom I revere greatly, and how his observations of the world and how his intellect and insight was just so, to me, so moving and so universally wonderful. And so Craig and I went back and forth, and Craig essentially edited a bunch of texts, and we together put together a libretto, if you will, and I set about writing it.
I mean, again, to go back to what we said earlier, Darwin never wrote these words thinking, boy, I hope someday someone sets this to music. And certainly no one would think in reading Darwin that someone would be inspired to write this to music. I know Craig put the text together, but there are a couple points. If you're looking for the Latin roots, you keep the words of the Kyrie.
Yep, the Kyrie is in there. So the opening movement is...
Yet the first word of the whole thing is ignorance.
Yes.
I mean, it's very powerful juxtaposition. I want to get to another one too, but go ahead.
Yeah. So the opening movement, once you get past sort of the introitus, is Christ have mercy, Lord have mercy, followed directly by one general law. Let the strongest live and the weakest die, which is sort of this distillation of natural selection. And where you have, on the case of like Lord have mercy, this idea of something merciful, and directly same exact music, completely different text, one where there is, you know, essentially no mercy, this idea of natural selection. That's an oversimplification in many ways, but the basic idea is that you have this very old idea right counterposed with this newer idea. And that was sort of the big thought behind the mass as a whole, was this sort of like thinking about the ways that we believe and thinking about the ways that we revere institutions or thoughts or humans. And it was a way for me to celebrate the way that I feel like we are all interconnected, and that nature is in its own way absolutely splendid and worthy of a Gloria.
Dipping back again to the recording of the Missa Charles Darwin by my guest today, Gregory Brown, is sung by New York Polyphony. Here's the second movement, the Gloria.
Different yet dependent.
The other, to me, when I listen to the stark juxtaposition, is you actually take the Alleluia movement and stick that in it, because Alleluia goes at the end as well. And that word, I mean, one of the highest words of praise in any faith to the divine being, choices of leaving that in, because that's such a stark contrast to Darwin.
Yeah, that movement and the sort of recapitulation of that idea, I think in my mind it had to do a lot with sort of celebrating in a much more general sense, but also it was a way to sort of have things come together a little bit in a detente, if you will.
It's an interesting choice of that word, you know, because that word does span all religions that believe in God, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
You wrote it for the Four Voices, Four Guys from New York Polyphony. You have written an expanded version now for chorus, is that true? Yeah, so.
Yeah, there was a choir in London. They got in touch with me and they really wanted to do it. And I said, all right, well, I expanded it, I transposed it a bit. It was in some ways tricky. It's a very different animal. The choir is a different animal from solo voices.
Yeah.
And so I did a version for this choir in London. And then just last year, a choir in Seattle, the Esoterics, did a revision. The experience of having that in London, so it's like, okay, this worked, this didn't work, and I was able to rewrite it, and I think it was much more successful.
So the idea of the Misa Charles Darwin is an interesting idea. It was recorded. In fact, it came out on this in a version on the Navona label, this very incredibly deluxe packaging. and, you know, so choirs in London are picking up.
Yeah.
But this is going to now jump even to a higher notch of exposure because it's going to inspire another piece of art on the literary side. Because your brother is one of the most successful novelists going, and that's Dan Brown. And we think of The Da Vinci Code and Inferno and Angels and Demons, and probably the most mentioned novelist from the pulpit in history, in modern history, when, he, of course, they were all, you know, railing against the blasphemy in his books. But it was him hearing your work, which inspired his, it's his latest book, right? Origin.
Yep.
He hasn't written one since then.
Yep.
Origin, which I'm sure will be made into a movie that will star Tom Hanks and all the rest of that, as some of his other novels have been. So that story of him hearing your work and then your work appearing in his book, which, like I said, will probably eventually appear in a movie. So
I'm excited for that. But yeah, I mean, he came to a concert that New York Polyphony put on and was really sort of taken with the piece, and you know, we talked about it afterwards, and we talked about it every once in a while, and then and then several years went by, and he emailed me and says, I gotta show you something, I'm working on something, can I show you something? And I said, yeah, of course, yeah, send it along. And it's the passage from the book in its, you know, rawest form. And he says, what do you think? Are you okay with this? Did I get the language right? And I helped him with a little bit of the just language, making sure he was sort of talking about the music in a way that was accurate and musicologically correct.
Right.
And yeah, I was floored. I was really surprised. But yeah, I'm honored, of course. I mean, it's been a really fun 12 months or so.
Now, in the scene that's in the book, I mean, your music is being played. So I don't know if you can give away just what happens. I mean, how does that work into the what's happening?
It's actually hard to talk about without giving stuff away.
Okay.
But it is, it's
published.
It's heard, and it's part of a longer conversation about the sorts of things that we're talking about.
Yeah, because the book deals with somebody who comes out and says that they have a secret, which relates to Darwin and the whole genesis of man and creation of man. And of course, there's a lot of intrigue that involved.
Of course, there's a lot of intrigue.
Robert Langdon has to get involved. But this actually sources itself into a sacred setting set in Barcelona and near music. Is this the first time the two of you have had that kind of symbiosis, or did you discuss your art?
Yeah, we talk about this stuff all the time. So we used to play floor hockey in the basement for hours and hours.
Yeah.
And we would talk about everything. He's like 10 years older than me, so he was off at college and I'm a teenager, and he's telling me about all the stuff he's learning.
Yeah.
And I remember him telling me about, he was taking a class in cosmology and talking about the cosmos and all this stuff. And I was just so excited about this. But these are the sorts of things we talk about all the time. He was a musician for many years. He was a singer-songwriter.
Okay.
And so, you know, we would talk about music all the time. He still does music sort of quietly. He does music on, yeah, he's a talented guy. And, you know, I'll share what I'm working on with him, and he shares what he's working on with me. And we talk about his books. We talk about my music. I talk about his music and so forth.
We share a lot. But it's just really fun that your music inspired the next book.
That was unexpected, yes.
Yeah, and he might be saying, what else you got going in there? What's that piece about the club and reservoir? What are you going?
Oh, that would make for a very interesting
next one set in Western Massachusetts, Dan Brown book. Watch for it at your local bookstores and on Amazon.
And yet again, turning to the Misa Charles Darwin as sung by New York Polyphony, this the third movement, the interpolated Alleluia, setting again words from Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, music by my guest today, Gregory Brown.
We've talked about your Polyphony. Your music has been recorded by The Crossing. We work closely with Don Nally. We've broadcast The Crossing many years, and we broadcast his other hat, which is his Northwestern University group, on our Monday night program. And then you mentioned Skylark, Matthew Guard. We've broadcast them last Good Friday with their Seven Last Words. And so we're going to be working with them in the future. To have these type of choral groups, your music is not easy, but I mean, to step up and not only want to do your music, but really champion it. I mean, just talk about the whole choral world right now, where you have these ensembles which are not just interested in doing new music. They're exemplary as far as how they sing and how they approach it. It must just be glorious as a composer.
It's nice. I mean, working with Donald and the Crossing is a dream come true, really. Yeah. I mean, the first time we did a recording project, maybe 5 years ago, and they had my music, and you know, I was nervous. I knew they were good, and I was nervous. And they had a rehearsal without me, and I came into the second rehearsal, and it was ready. It was just my jaw was on the floor because they got it. And we spent some time, you know, really fine tuning things, but it was like, should it be, you know, 88 or 90, you know, 90 beats per minute, or, you know, how are we going to articulate this one particular syllable here? It was the sort of fine tuning and really nitty gritty stuff that I love. And we were able to get right to it. It was wonderful. This last project I did with them, Unbodyings, was similar. I just was in heaven, really. They're not only technically adept and fearless, but they really, really, truly care about the music. And likewise, working with Matthew and Skylark, they get in and they want to chew on it. They want to know what's going on. They really want to get to what's great about it. So for me, it's been wonderful. I think it's great. And
yeah, because these aren't like outlying choral groups anymore. These are some of the top choral groups going, mm-hmm. and their emphasis, mm-hmm. a lot of it is on brand new music for voice. I mean, you don't want to be labeled a choral composer. I mean, you've done some other chamber works, piano works, mm-hmm. like electroacoustic works. Do you want to get out in? I mean, is opera on the horizon? Is large symphonic or orchestral or instrumental things?
I have a piece that's going to be premiered by the Malta Philharmonic over in Malta, like yeah. in the Mediterranean. That was kind of a weird project that dropped in my lap in many ways. And I said, yeah, of course. So it's a 11-minute piece for a full orchestra. It'll be premiered in Valletta in February. Yeah, I'm going to go over. I've written a little bit for orchestra, but the opportunity to write for a full orchestra, it's not often that you get that opportunity. So I'm very excited about that. And I would love to do an opera at some point. I've written a fair amount of art song. My yeah. wife is a very fine soprano, so I have the luxury of writing something and calling upstairs and saying, how crazy is this? And she'll come down and be like, oh, it's actually doable. That's fine. Or no, you never want to do that. So I've learned a lot from her and Todd Heron, who wrote the text for yeah. Unbodyings. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal poet. And actually a very fine musician too. He's got a really good ear, in part because he lives in the folk music. He plays banjo and mandolin. Yeah, he's quite a guy. And so, you know, we've talked, Todd and I have talked a little bit about maybe doing an opera at some point. Opera's tricky. It's yeah. expensive. There's so many people involved. It's something that would probably take 3 or 4 years to sort of put everything together. But I hope someday to write an opera, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, composers usually love the experience or hate the experience. There's very little gray area in opera where they love it so much then they keep writing operas. Think of like a Paul Moravec yeah. or something like that. And somebody who the opera experience, like a John Harbison, is just so awful that, you know, it's like... And I guess the first step to that, same, because some of your choral works are very narrative, and what they flesh out is it's just finding the right vehicle, the right
yep.
story, the right libretto. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have somebody talented to turn it into a libretto, is that the same process that you use for setting text for voice for choir? Is just something else strike you, or do you keep a short list? Or I mean, that's too also with the text you're going to set for choir. Is this like a short list? You got something going that I'll get to it? Or because you said you hear things in two lines, but you may not be ready at that moment to do the composing.
I keep a little folder on my computer, text ideas. I also have this great, I have two books that I picked up at a book fair years ago, and they are texts for speaking choir. And the speaking choir was this thing that was popular in the early 20th century. And you would see the text, it would, you know, whatever, quatrain. And at the beginning of the line in italics would be H for high voices, which would be tenors and sopranos, or L for low voices, or M for men, women, yeah. and solos. And they were texts, you know, standard Tennyson or whatever, that were specifically chosen and arranged, if you will, for speaking choir. I've never heard one of these things live. But the thing about this book, which is great, is that the texts are, they're wonderful texts.
Yeah.
And they're texts that are the sorts of things that were probably very popular in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and have been forgotten. So it's a great place to be like, oh, and even if I don't like that particular text, I'd be like, oh, this poet is really interesting, and I can track down the poet.
You mentioned the Malta orchestral work, mm-hmm. and you've got this list on your computer. Can you give us a teaser? What's ahead? What's short-term ahead? What are you working on?
What I'm working on right now is a piece for Variant 6, which is six singers yeah. out of The Crossing. And they're actually going to premiere it here in Princeton in February. That's a piece, it's called Fall and Decline, and it's five movements. The texts are all about civilizations in decline.
Okay. Are we included on
Well, actually, there is the middle piece is a text, again, by Todd Heron from the Bush 1 era yeah. about sort of the Gulf War.
Yeah.
But it's oddly applicable to today, too. Yeah. And so there's the fall of Egypt, the fall of Rome, and then there's these two other sort of poems that are a little little less. One's an Omar Khayyam poem, and the other is a text by Sadakichi Hartman, who is a Japanese-American, I guess you might even call him like an early beat poet, kind of.
Okay.
Really interesting poet from the sort of first middle half of the 20th century. Yeah, he was one of the ones that promoted the sort of anglicization of haiku and a couple of other Japanese forms.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And that's in February.
That's in February here at All Saints in Princeton.
Do you work on more than one piece at once, or are you kind of one at a time?
I try not to.
One time.
I really try and dig in deeply. When I had this Variant 6 commission and the Malta commission at the same time, I finished the orchestra piece. And that's all off at the engraver now, right, getting all cleaned up. And now I can dig into this other piece.
Yeah, I'm sure there are composers who can do it, but I think working with text, it'd be hard to work on multiple pieces at once, because that text has to be front and center of what you're working with. Whereas you're working abstractly with just instrumental music, maybe you can bounce back and forth, maybe. But
yeah, I mean, it's funny. I tend to do, I take a lot of walks.
Yeah.
I work in the garden, and some of the best work I do is actually way away from the piano. And if I don't have it internalized and really is part of my sort of running internal monologue, then I don't get the same depth of work out of it. It's funny, I was just talking to somebody, Alice Parker is up in my area in Western Mass, and I was just talking to, so I conduct a community choir up there, and some of my singers are good friends with Alice, and I was talking to this friend of Alice, and we were talking about the same sorts of things, texts. And this friend of Alice's said, oh yeah, Alice will memorize the text and live with it for weeks and weeks before she even starts writing. Yeah, that's, she's good.
Yeah.
So I took that as like, oh, okay, maybe I should even go farther. Maybe I should memorize these texts and just not even get into it. I tend to take the text and just sort of go at it headlong, jump in and write maybe 30 or 40 seconds worth of music and then stop. Because usually I've gotten myself in way over my head, which is good. And then I step away from it for days or weeks and then come back to it and say, oh, okay, this is what I was sort of maybe subconsciously getting at. And then you can start to bring things out of it.
Well, keep it all coming. You know, I mean, just keep turning.
So a short instrumental work by my guest today, Gregory Brown, a world premiere recording of a little piano piece performed by Thomas Strumpf from a CD called Reflections on Time and Mortality, featuring works by many different composers. This piece by my guest is titled Suite and 20. Thank you.
close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat, like we've been chatting, with someone from the past. Somebody never had a chance to, but could. When I ask that, sometimes you get flooded with names. When I ask that, what name popped into your head?
Brahms.
Brahms.
Absolutely.
Really?
Oh, I just adore his music. And I adore the image of him down at the Red Hedgehog, just playing cigar in hand or out of the corner of his mouth. You know, probably drinking either cherry or God knows what, coffee, and just playing. I imagine he would play, you know, maybe one of his intermezzos and then some popular song. And so I'd love to talk to him just about how he thinks about religion in particular, knowing his Requiem and folk music. I think he's somebody who I would really enjoy just having a long conversation with.
I told this story recently on another cadenza, but years ago I was interviewing Leon Fleischer, the great pianist, and he took a masterclass with Arthur Schnabel. And Schnabel told the story, I don't know if you know the story, that he and his classmates, I guess, I'm not really sure about that, got a chance to meet Brahms and go walking with Brahms, which was huge, right, for these kids, right? Absolutely. Brahms said two things to them the entire day. He asked them if they were hungry. And after they ate, he asked them if they had enough to eat. And that's all they heard from Brahms the entire day. So not a man of many words. They could be caustic words. I also think Brahms was funny because if he could have been born in a different time and a different place, he'd made a good New Englander. I think that would have fit his personality.
I agree very much.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Just to the point and suffer no fools. The second question is non-musical. Mm-hmm. You've already mentioned your kids and all that, but I mean, everybody I interview in Cadenza is very busy with music, as you are. But when you have to get away from music, a respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do if you need to pull away, get your mind away?
I go outside. I've gotten back into photography. I have a digital camera, but I also have some vintage cameras that I go with. 35 millimeter 120, sort of medium format Polaroids. I've got some old Polaroids that I work with now. A little tiny 110, terrible little mini camera, which it actually is just dreadful little camera. But, you know, I took almost 90 pictures this summer and two of them were great. That's actually not bad. That's not bad. But it was fun. It was fun. And
it's not a batting average you want to go with, 2 out of 90, but for,
you know,
pictures,
honestly,
it's okay.
Honestly, that's about right. If I get 1 to 5% of shots that are good, I'm like, yeah, that's all right. A lot of the time I'm out birding.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time actually in Quabbin. Unbodyings is all about this area called Quabbin. It's about 10 minutes from my house, and I spend a lot of time out there looking at birds, listening to birds. I think that's something that over the last few years has opened my eyes and ears in a way that's been very helpful for my music. Just thinking about the timbre of birds and how they communicate and learning them all has been very helpful to me.
Which means we have to double back and put a footnote on this. And back to the Mesa Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
Because musically, you've got birds. Birds provided part of the music of this. So tell that really quickly.
Yeah, so when Craig and I were first talking about this, I wanted there to be something that would link together a lot of different ideas. Mm-hmm. I hit upon this idea of using DNA as a generative musical idea. And so I went on the internet and I found an article which had bits and pieces of genetic information from Darwin's finches. And I translated those ACGT into tones, and that became sort of a motivic, generative musical device for me. So yeah, the DNA of one of the Darwin's finches is buried right in the middle of the piece.
Fascinating. Gregory Brown, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much, David.
Silently, silently, silently and insensibly.
Composer Gregory Brown. You can find out more about him at his website, gregorybrown.com. The recordings of his music appear mostly on the Innova and Navona record labels, Innova, INNOVA.MU, and Navona, NAVONA records.com. And his brother's book, Origin, is out and available at all booksellers. And yes, my guest's music is in the story, and as far as the movie, well, we'll assume it is coming soon. You can hear my guest's music live in concert on February 16th at All Saints Episcopal Church, 16 All Saints Road in Princeton, performed by the group Variant 6, a world premiere of his work titled Fall and Decline. It's presented by the Contemporary Undercurrent of Song Project. You can check everything out at contemporaryundercurrent.com. I leave you with the final movement of that Mesa Charles Darwin, the Agnus Dei, once again sung by the group that inspired the work from my guest, the Male Quartet New York Polyphony, music of my guest today, Gregory Brown. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Existence.